Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. If you're just joining us, this hour we are listening to stories from the Trapdoor Coming-of-Age Story Showcase. Next up, we have Steve Miller, who as a younger man worked for the Iran-Contra Committee in Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening.
So my story about coming of age is, like John said, when I was living in Washington, D.C., so this was early to mid-20s, so kind of that period in life where you're feeling pretty good about being an adult, and then in some other ways, I'm not quite ready for this adulthood thing here. So I was working as an elevator operator in the Capitol, which I've told that story here before, but I was working as an elevator operator in the Capitol, hoping to get a better job, and I got a call one day from a woman who worked at the placement office, which is a kind of a job center place in the Senate, wondering if I'd be interested in a job at the Iran-Contra Committee. Now, this is the Iran-Contra, Oliver North illegally selling arms to Iran and then using the profits to fund the Contras. Big deal. Kind of the Watergate of the 80s. People were wondering if Reagan is going to end up being impeached. I don't know how to make a connection or parallel to what's going on today. It's too bizarre. But so I'm like, yeah, I would be interested in a job at the Iran-Contra Committee. So I went to have an interview, and I remember it was on a Friday, and the interview went well, and she said, when could you start? And I said, actually, I could start on Monday. And she said, what about tomorrow? And on Saturday? Okay. So yeah, we work every Saturday. And they said it would be answering the phone mostly and making copies. And I said, I'll take it, because I knew that it would be more than that. I show up on day one, and I'm making copies. And there's a machine about as big as this stage, practically, this huge copy machine. And anytime we were doing stuff there, we had to make like multiple sets of copies for all the different senators or people on the committee. So like 20 plus sets of the same thing. So it's, Steve, we need a set of this. So I go back there to the copy machine, and there's this button that I wasn't aware of called that does collating. Never had heard of that, because my previous jobs before this in reverse chronological order were answering mail in Gary Hart's office when he was a senator, washing dishes in the frat house in college, mowing a lot of lawns, working at a Friendly's up on St. Joe Center Road, and working at Long John Silver's. Those were my previous jobs, so not a lot of office experience. And so I have this stack of papers, put it in the thing, and it all comes out, and it's not really set up to be 20 copies. So I'm down on the floor, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 2. And then she walked in, her name was Victoria, one of the attorneys. And this move, parents know this move, when you have your hands on your shoulder, or your sides, like, you're ready to shoot somebody. What happened? I'm like, I didn't know what collating was. And I think the guys on the committee who'd already been working there for a while, like, hey, the new guy didn't know about collating, can you believe it? And I'm thinking, I'm done by lunch. They're like, don't bother coming back, buddy, keep on moving. But I made it through that first day, and I remember leaving after a long day of making copies, and it was pouring down rain. It had been a nice day when I came in, it was pouring down rain, and I'm running to the subway stop and thinking, what the heck have I gotten myself into? I should say it was raining, and we didn't know it was raining because the windows were blacked out in the office space we were in because, believe it or not, we were worried about Russians spying on us. Like, people don't worry about that today, but back then we were worried about it. So day two comes along, and it's kind of a better day because they say, we would like you to do some research on these emails of Oliver North. And yeah, I can do that. That's cool. So I'm doing that, and then things get better as it goes on. It's very intense. We're working very long days, coming in early in the morning, staying late at night. It's intense, but it's good. I'm doing some heavy-duty research for them. Every day I'm wearing a suit. I'm walking past the Capitol and the Library of Congress and the Supreme Court to get to work. It's kind of inspiring. And the hearings start. We're on TV. I meet maybe a young woman, and the inevitable, where do you work? I work at the Iran-Contra Committee. That was a really good answer in that time and place for what do you work, or where do you work? That was kind of like, that could take a nothing date and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. And down the road, I got my picture in the New York Times. That was probably the point where I was twirling around and throwing my hat in the air. So it goes well. And so it comes to a point after the hearings end that things are kind of winding down a little bit, and it gets to be October of that year, And one of my friends from college named Glenn was getting married. And Glenn lived in Boston. And so I had a couple other friends from college who also lived in D.C. And were like, so we're going to the wedding. How are we getting there? Well, we got to rent a car. So my friend Matt's dad calls around to find the best deal for us to rent a car. And the company Alamo is what he finds because all the miles are free. That was Alamo's tagline. All the miles are free. We've got to go from D.C. to Boston, which is 400 or 500 miles. So we rent a car. And I was the one of us who at that time had turned 25. So they needed, had to be 25 to rent a car in your name. And I'm like, I've got the credit card. I'm 25. And I'm an adult. You know, I'm doing well. No problem. So we rent the car and we head north. And I should say, this is a time, late 80s, no GPS. And we didn't have a map. I'm pretty sure we didn't even have a map. We may have looked at a map ahead of time to kind of figure our route, but no map. And believe it or not, young people, no cell phones. They did not exist then. So when you left your house, you were gone. I mean, if anybody wanted to reach you, if you went to the store, you might as well be in Inner Mongolia because they are not finding you. You are not there. End of story. So we head north, go hit a lot of traffic in Philadelphia. Then we're going to avoid New York City. That's the key thing, avoid New York City on the East Coast. So we go farther north to this place called Tappan Zee Bridge. We're going to cross that, head across Connecticut to Boston. When we crossed the bridge, my friend Matt was driving, and I had a feeling like we kind of should have gone to the left, and he went to the right, but like Matt's driving, he knows what he's doing, so I don't say anything. Maybe I did. I'm like, Matt, I think, no, it's fine, you're driving. We get a little farther along. I'm like, this just doesn't feel right. I'm not sure we're going where we're supposed to be going, but that nags at me. And then eventually I'm like, Matt, I'm pretty sure we took a wrong turn. Why do you say that? Because there's Yankee Stadium as we're passing them. Like, we're in the heart of New York City. So it takes much longer to get there than we expect, but we finally do get there. Everybody has a great time in Boston. This rental car kind of becomes a community car for all my college buddies. My friends Andy and Kevin borrow it in the middle of the night, unbeknownst to me, and in search of a Denny's, and end up in New Hampshire before they find a Denny's. But they, you know, everything's fine. We have a great time. Then it's time to come home, and a couple other friends from college who were also from D.C. were driving home too. They hadn't gone up there with us, but they had a car. So we're following them. And at some point when we're following them, they pull over and say, you know, we missed an exit here. We got in the wrong place. So we got to go to the next exit, get off, go across, come back, and get back where we need to be. And so we're doing that, and we come to the next exit. And instead of getting to the top of the exit and, you know, being able to go right or left, it's just we're just going to the right. There's no chance to go to the left. So Bob, who's driving ahead of us, does a U-turn. We do a U-turn. And as we're doing the U-turn, slam, we're T-boned by another car. So it's bad. The car, I mean, no one's hurt, but the car is not in good shape. And it turns out we are in the South Bronx when this happens. I should have mentioned earlier, too, that this very month of the wedding was when the book Bonfire of the Vanities was released. I don't know if any of you read that book or seen that movie, but that's serious foreshadowing. And if you're ever in an accident or an accident happens when you get to an area, most people, you know, they slow down or they stop. Is everybody okay? That type of thing. In New York, that's not what happens. In those, everybody starts yelling at you. And not nice things either. You know, things you can't really do to yourself that you've been told to do. And there's buses driving. There's a bus drove by that was taking people to prison that had bars on the sides of the bus. And those guys were yelling extremely not nice things to us. It was a little scary. So the cops show up, we finally take care of all the stuff with them, and then the cops are like, there's time for them to go, and the cop says, you know, you probably want to move this car, or it's not going to be here too much longer. We're like, okay, so the axle's bent, the car wobbles as we drive along the road to find somewhere to park it, this off the highway, and we go to the first place and park the car, and we are in the South Bronx. Picture Fort Apache, the Bronx, Taxi Driver, basically any dystopian zombie movie you can imagine. That's what it felt like as we were in the South Bronx. And we're like, again, no cell phones, so we have to find a phone to call Alamo to tell them. And it's in my name, so everyone's like, Steve, it's your thing. You got to call them. I'm like, okay. So we find a payphone, believe it or not, that works. And I call Alamo, and I say my name, and we were in an accident. Okay, where are you? We're in New York City. You're not supposed to be in New York. What do you mean we're not supposed to be in New York? You're not supposed to be in New York. it says on your contract you're not supposed to be in New York City. I'm like, well, all the miles are free. So if you're in Washington, D.C., and you want to go to New York to get to Boston, and you can't go through New York, you have, as I see it, two options. One, you could backtrack through Maryland, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, cross the border, Ontario, Quebec, down through New Hampshire, and make it over to Boston. That'd be option one. Option two, as I see it, the only other thing you could do, when you're in D.C. and you go to Alamo and you say, yes, I'm interested in renting a car, and they say, what kind of car would you like to rent, sir? I think I need a chitty, chitty, nika, nika, bang, bang car that can fly across the ocean because I can't go through New York. Okay, that's, thank you. All right, so, all right, now you got the picture with that. And so Alamo's like, well, you got to get the car back to us. We'll send a tow truck from D.C. to New York to get the car. $600 to do that. We're like, okay, that's a lot of money for guys in our mid-20s, but, you know, if this car stays here too long, it is not going to be here for anyone to find. So, all right, send the tow truck, fine. Then what are we going to do? Because the other car doesn't have room for everybody to fit in to get home. So we call another friend from college who was from New York and was already home. So we called, and this is kind of the part of the story where, like, I'm thinking, you know, the importance of good friends who were, you know, a friend in need is a friend indeed type of thing really sunk into me. So we call Eric, and he comes eventually and picks us up, and Matt and Andy and I go spend the night at Eric's place, and the rest of the guys head back to D.C. So what do you do in that situation? We call our parents because, again, I'm not quite ready for this adult thing. You know, we were in an accident. It's not good to call our parents. Matt's dad says, you know, I will testify in court if I have to that they said all the miles are free and they never said anything about not going to New York. And I'm like, I don't want to be going to court, but okay. And I call my dad and he says, and by the way, as a parent now, I'm thinking, they are thinking the entire time, thank God they're okay, thank God they're okay. But, you know, we're trying to deal with the situation. And my dad says, you know, the credit card's in your name, yes. Cancel the credit card tomorrow. That's a good idea by my dad because then they can't get to me any more than they already have. Andy calls home to find out that the entire time that he had been gone, he lived in Chicago, the entire time he had been gone, his alarm was going off in his condo. And I've witnessed this alarm before. It's about like this. Like constant, 24/7, going off the entire time he's gone. His neighbors are going crazy, of course. And they are, no cell phones, no way to reach him. He had an unusual last name, so they were trying to call. He's not there. He's in Inner Mongolia, not there. So his parents are also lived in town, and people were trying to call them, and they were not home. But eventually they got home. And someone said, you know, please come. They had a key, so they went over there. No cell phone, no way to reach Andy, so the alarm thing's going off, so they didn't know the code, so they just cut the wires to get this thing to shut up finally. And so they're telling all this to Andy, and he says, well, you know, what happened? Did somebody break into my apartment? And his mother had one of the great mom lines of all time. She said, Andy, your place is always such a mess, I can't even tell. So Andy flies home from New York the next day to go deal with his thing, and Matt and I take the train back to D.C., and again, I'm thinking the whole time, like, it's in my name, it's in my name, it's my name, this is not good, this is not good. But we get back, and I tell the director of our committee what happened and why I was a day late getting back there, and she had a friend who was an attorney. Like, every third person in D.C. is an attorney, and she referred me to him, and so I met with him. And I, again, learned kind of like it's not, you know, who you know is a big thing in life. So this attorney was very cool, and he agreed to only charge me the rate of his paralegal, about $25 an hour instead of like over $100 of his time. And he wrote a couple letters to Alamo and kind of got him to back off because they were threatening, you know, the thousands of dollars for this car. They were going to take away my license, my registration, you know, really screw me up for life. And it was intimidating, obviously, to be looking at something like that. And they kind of backed off after a few letters from an attorney. So a couple years went by. I eventually got a different job in D.C. and then did that for a while. And then that ended. And I moved back to Fort Wayne. And one day I was at my parents' house, and the phone rang. and so-and-so calling representing Alamo. I'm like, oh, how the hell did they track me down to my parents' house in Fort Wayne? I have no idea how they did that, but they did. And they started to say blah, blah, blah. And I said, and I remember this distinctly, I said, you know, I've always wanted to say this to somebody, and now I'm going to say it to you. You're going to have to speak to my attorney. And I went click. And this wasn't a cell phone. This was a real heavy-duty phone that went click like that. So in that very moment, I remember a feeling that I'm grown up. This is good. I've made it. That's my story.
The Trapdoor Coming of Age continues, and a reminder that all the stories you've heard during our show can be found at WBOI.org. Our next speaker is Josh Elias, a multi-instrumentalist and amateur writer who will share a story of family and recovering from addiction.
So I'm going to kind of preface my story here for you guys a little bit by telling you a little bit of something about myself. I've kind of realized fairly recently over the last several months that I have this amazing ability, and I use this word amazing loosely, to create just really shitty situations for myself in my life. And while I'm creating these terrible debacles, I have the ability to kind of step out of myself and kind of mystically watch as I create these awful situations. And then after they're fully in motion, I just have the urge to just run headstrong into them as fast as I can. And then after everything's just collapsing around me, I stand back and go, what the hell did I just do? This is insane. So I try to come up with an analogy of what the last several years of my life is like. And I came up with this. Imagine, if you will, you are in this home that you have, and it's a big, beautiful home, and you have a large can of gasoline with you. And you're going about room to room, and you're haphazardly throwing this gas on your beds and your floors and kitchen appliances, your curtains and drapes, and you eventually get a little tired. So you go outside for a smoke. You sit down on your front steps and you light up, and you just kind of throw the match back behind you. And within a couple minutes, your whole house is just in a total blaze. And you step back and go, oh my God, my whole house is on fire. And then you kind of get excited about it because it's, you know, it's awesome. It's like, oh my God, look what I did. And so you rip your clothes off and you go running into the house as fast as you can. You're gallivanting around in this blaze that's happening around you. That's me over the last few years of my life. So I was born and raised here in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I grew up here in the late 80s and into the 90s, which was a really good time. I had a pretty good life. I was born to two great parents, and I have a younger brother. My father was a foreman for a local construction company, and my mom was an RN at Parkview. We never really went for want. Everything was really good until I turned about 7 or 8 years old. This time in my life, my father, he started to stop coming home from work at the end of the day. We had no idea where he was. My brother and I, being so young, we didn't think much about it at first. And then this started to happen more frequently. And as it happened more frequently, we obviously started to take notice that, you know, obviously my mom was very worried. She had two young boys at home. We had no idea where my dad was going. And eventually one day, she sat my brother and I down. I was probably, like I said, about 8. My brother would have been about 5. And she explained to us that our father was a crack cocaine addict. I don't have a ton of memory of this time in my life. Our brains kind of have this awesome mechanism built inside of them that just blocks out serious moments of trauma, thankfully. So I can't really even imagine the emotions that I was experiencing during this time. Obviously, it was awful. One memory that I do carry with me, and that I've carried with me my entire life, is coming out of my bedroom when I was young to the sound of my mother weeping. And I walked downstairs, and I found my mom on her hands and knees on the floor. My dad had come home. He was high as a kite. And my mom was begging him not to leave and go back out and continue using that day. He had our family's VCR camera under his arm. And I remember the look on his face. As he pushed my mom off, he said he was sorry, and he walked out of our house. I remember at that point in my life that I told myself that I was never going to be the man or the father that my dad had become. And as you'll soon find out, this dangerously almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy for me. So things kind of progressed with my dad, progressively got worse, to the point where he was arrested for possession of crack cocaine and went to jail. At that point, my mom had had enough. She divorced him, rightfully so, and eventually got remarried. After my dad got out of jail, he kind of started to get his life back to, together the best that he could, just kind of collecting the different pieces of his puzzle. My mom let us have a relationship with him, for better or worse, and he ended up moving to a lake house up in Columbia City. Anybody that's ever spent any amount of time on a lake in Indiana knows what a total clusterfuck these things are. It's just a constant party. With that said, I started drinking at the age of 12 with my father. And I'm not talking about just sneaking some Boone's Farm into your Kool-Aid or a couple beers here and there. I mean, I'm talking hardcore drinking. I remember one time I passed out in the front lawn of our house and there was a party going on and somebody just came and just laid a towel over me. And like I said, I was about 12 or 13 years old. What these adults were thinking is totally beyond me. Inevitably, I started smoking weed when I was 15. By the time I was 16, I was doing mushrooms, ecstasy, LSD, and eventually cocaine. Needless to say, I was a mess. I went through my high school years just kind of doing what I could to get through school, doing the least amount of work possible. I finally graduated, miraculously. About the time I was 19, I really thought I knew what I was doing, and I got married for the first time, which if there's anybody here that got married when you're 19, you probably also know what it's like to get divorced when you're 20, so I was right about there. I was, like I said, I was a total mess. I was directionless, just living my life in a total fog. In my early 20s, I was introduced to the local electronic music scene here, where I spent about the last 10 years of my life. The only really good thing that came of that time was that I met my wife, who's the love of my life and who I would probably say saved my life this year. We now share a daughter together. My wife has her own story and her own journey, so I'll kind of leave her story out of this. But I'll just add that I kind of thought that having a child would really kind of wake me up. It would give me more of a purpose than just getting high all the time. And it did for about a year. And then at the end of that year, we kind of just got sucked back into the routine of throwing parties, being at parties. If there wasn't a party going on, I was probably partying by myself, because that's what you do when you're an addict. About 3 years ago, we joined up with a couple of close friends of ours and we formed a collective here in Fort Wayne. And then what we did was throw parties, and we were very good at it. We threw a party every Saturday for 2.5 years. I don't know if anybody's ever been involved in throwing an event on this type of regular basis, but it's grueling. And when you add to that the fact that you are just partying your ass off all weekend for 2.5 years, things get a little out of control. There were times where we would be up all night on Saturdays. Sunday morning would roll around and I'd feel myself coming down. So I'd get drunk and I'd crash out on my couch by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, only to have my 3-year-old daughter pulling on my arm, telling me to wake up so I can make her some dinner. This is where I was. I thought I had things under control. Remember, like I said, you know, you're naked in your house and it's burning around you. That was me at that point. So things kind of progressed like this until they couldn't anymore. And things finally came to a head this last February. I was using cocaine on a regular basis. I was drinking every day. My wife had to go out of town for a few days, and I was put in charge of our 4-year-old daughter. I was supposed to take her to school, take her around to different activities. So one day I woke up, it was a Thursday, and I remember doing several lines of cocaine, having several drinks, and then I threw my daughter in the car to take her to preschool. After taking her to school, I decided to go to my parents' house, which was right around the corner. I knew they'd be at work, and I knew that my stepfather's refrigerator would be packed full of beer. So I went there. I remember what the day was like. It was a really nasty day. It was cold, just classic Indiana winter. And I was sitting at their kitchen table. I'd had a few drinks. I was listening to some sad, pathetic music and writing some poetry. And while I was doing this, I had this wave come over me, and it was just sheer hopelessness. And the idea crawled into my mind that I could go up to my parents' medicine cabinet. I could clear it out, make a huge pill cocktail, and I could go ahead and drink it down, go to my bedroom that I grew up in, and not wake up. What really scared me about this was how good of an idea it sounded to me at the time. Like, I really let it sit in my head for way too long, to the point where I was standing at my parents' stairway, and I started to go upstairs to their bathroom to go into their medicine cabinet. That's how close I was. To this day, I really don't know what stopped me. I kind of chalk it up to divine intervention or whatever you'd like to say. Whatever it was, it shook me hard enough to snap out of the fog that I was in and literally sent me running out of their house. The next couple of days were filled with drinking, continued use of hard narcotics, until finally I had a complete mental breakdown. I had a downright panic attack, an anxiety attack. Years of drug and alcohol use and untreated depression finally came crashing down on me. At that point, my mom talked to my wife and told her it was time to take me to the hospital. She took me, and that day I was checked into Parkview Behavioral Health. I was 30 years old. Going to Parkview was probably the turning point for me. I spent a week there, and after I finished my stint in rehab, I enrolled myself in their intensive outpatient program, which consists of 2 months of 3 hours a night, 3 nights a week of intense group therapy. When I enrolled, I really didn't even think that I needed help. I was still thought I had my shit together. Again, house burning down, I'm naked. That's, yeah, good scenario there. And so that's where I was at. But after I went through a few sessions, I realized that, yes, this is something that I absolutely need to do for myself and for my family. I need to get clean. I need to become a better man. I don't know if anybody here has ever gone through the grueling process of getting clean from drugs and alcohol, but it is the first couple of weeks are really tough, not just physically and mentally, but also spiritually and emotionally. You're sad, you're angry, you kind of feel directionless. You're happy to be getting clean and getting your life back together, but at the same time, you just really don't have much focus. Your friends that you used to be around no longer talk to you, and you have very few people left. You're basically starting from scratch. But thankfully, with time, my mind started to change. My brain started to pull itself out of the sludge of bile that I'd been pouring onto it for the last decade. I don't remember the exact moment, but I do remember one morning I woke up and I thought to myself, wow, I'm sober, and I feel absolutely phenomenal. This was a turning point for me. As time has gone on and my sobriety has gone on, my intellect has kind of gone right in pace with it. Over the last several years, I'd lost total interest in doing anything that I'd consider intellectually stimulating. I stopped reading. I really wasn't interested in art very much, but now it's not uncommon for me to be going through 4 or 5 different books at once. My wife and I regularly have very deep conversations with one another and our close friends about living purpose-driven and intentional lives, living very fulfilling lives. I remember a few months ago, my wife was talking to me and she said, "Everything we do in our life now is with purpose and with intention. Everything we think, everything we do, everything we say, everything we spend our time on is intentional and with purpose." And so I really like this. So I started kind of using this as my mantra in my daily life, living a purpose-filled and intentional life. And as I started doing this, I started asking myself the question, what is the simplest and most rudimentary form of purpose that one can have in their life? And the answer came to me in the form of a 76-year-old man that I've been friends with for about the last 12 years, and who I also think might be insane. But nonetheless, he was sitting with me at my office at work one day, and I remember we were having a conversation. And randomly, in the middle of the conversation, his eyes got really big, and he looked at me, and he said, "Josh, do you want to know what I think the purpose of life is?" I was like, "Oh my God, yes, tell me, please." And he just looked at me, and he said, "I think the basic purpose of life is to build deep and meaningful connections with our fellow human, and of simply being of service to one another." My mind was blown. I'd asked the question, and here the universe provided it for me. Living a life of purpose is simply making connections with one another and being of service to one another. I loved it. So I started to practice this in my day-to-day life. I wanted to start small. I was reminded of the quote from Mother Teresa that I'm paraphrasing here. She said, "We cannot all do great things in life, but we all can do many small things with great love." What a great thing to say. What a great way to live. So I started small. A warm and genuine smile to a stranger here. A kind word of compassion or encouragement to my coworker there. And as I started to practice these things in my day-to-day life, I started to feel a true emotional feeling of contentment and real happiness building within inside of me. And as this started to happen, I started to push myself a little bit further. I wanted to have more meaningful connections with people. So I started talking to my staff at my work and urging them to have more meaningful and deeper connections with one another. Don't just be a coworker to somebody, be a friend. Get to know these people, get to know your neighbor. And as I started to do this, I saw them start to reach out to other people that were around them. And these things started to manifest in front of me. And as these manifestations were happening, I was filled with more and more joy and more happiness. The Dalai Lama teaches us that one of the most basic purposes of life, he feels, is simply find true happiness and to rid yourself of suffering. I really can't agree with this more. I really feel like that all the things that I'm talking about here tonight, finding purpose, having genuine connections with your fellow man, being of service to them, and being filled with joy and happiness as a result of your actions, I feel like these things start to perpetuate themselves. These are cycles, and they can continue to build and build. I used to spend a lot of my time getting high on chemicals and just doing really nonsensical, meaningless things. But now I get high on being the purest form of myself that I can possibly be, one of compassion and love for myself and for those around me. Throughout the course of my life, I've gone through what I would consider two paradigm shifts in how I view reality and how I live my life. One was when I turned 25, and then the other was this year when I turned 31. The shift that I went through recently this year taught me a lot of things, but one of the biggest things that stands out to me is the idea that all of us are brought into this world with all of the tools and capabilities that we need to live very fulfilling, purpose-driven, and meaningful lives. We simply have to reach out and say yes to the moments that life affords to us when we let go of our egos and we shed this kind of outer skin that we kind of build around us. Everything that I've gone through in my life has taught me something, and obviously there's been the good and the bad, but I don't regret any of it because it has gotten me to where I am here today. One thing that I can say from my story for sure is that I am by no means the boy that I once was, and I am for sure not the man that I'll eventually be.
The Trapdoor Coming of Age will continue after a short break. Thank you for listening to 89.1 WBOI.